Hello again, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Podcast, which is posted and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. Our show focuses on politics, economics, and culture here in the Heartland region, and my focus today is on politics in one of the most hotly contested races in the entire country, right here in eastern Iowa. My guest today is the Democratic candidate for this seat. She's Rita Hart. A lot of people are familiar with Rita. She's a former state senator and family farmer from right up not too far from the Quad City region near Wheatland, Iowa. Senator, thanks for taking the time today to meet with us, talk with us.
Yeah, Robin, I'm really happy to be here and thrilled that you started this new podcast. I hope that's been an exciting new adventure for you.
You know what? It has been. It's been fun. I talked to not only political candidates, but authors and pundits, all types of people, and kind of keep a focus on our region because it's an important region in so many ways, economically, but also politically. So, and again, Iowa's right in the middle of things again with your race. As I explained last week when I spoke with your opponent, for our listeners who maybe don't know politics that much, this is an open seat. It's Dave Loebsack's seat, and he retired. And so open seats normally are more competitive than seats with incumbents. So that's why this one has drawn so much attention across the country. But what I wanted to start with was just we're just in unprecedented times. And I'm sure as a candidate and somebody who's run for office before, it's just a completely different experience. But in the middle of a pandemic like this, with none of us have experienced to this degree. Looking back, I mean, how do you think this was handled effectively? I mean, our economy went into a deep recession. We're struggling to get out of it. But looking back, and I think it's fair to ask people this: should this have been handled differently at the federal level, and what should have been done differently?
Yeah, so when this first came about, it was, really take people by surprise. But leadership does matter. And as we have heard from various reports, you know, the fact that people had an opportunity to get ahead of this a bit more than they did is really disappointing. What I think is the important thing now is that we are taking care of what's happening right now. And that's where, you know, I think it's very disappointing that we haven't been able to bring down the rate of infection to a place where we are more able to lead a fairly normal life. And I think the proof is in the situation we're in, you know, that the United States has not done as well as other countries, and that Iowa has not done as well as other states. And so, you know, I think it's fair to say that we ought to be really taking a look at what we should be doing that we haven't been able to do to this point. And it's really disappointing that, again, we had an opportunity, you know, to bring people together. You know, I think about it in terms of, you know, we just had a windstorm go through here and hit our farm pretty hard along with many of my neighbors and friends. And in typical style, when there's a crisis, people come together, and our friends and our neighbors and our family tackled this problem together, regardless of any political affiliations, right? That's the way we ought to have handled this crisis. And instead, I think we really are struggling because it's become too political. And the only solution to that would be to rely on the scientists who understand what has to be done. And so we're still struggling here in Iowa in following the CDC guidelines and following the things that Dr. Fauci is saying. We've got to have our leaders step up and follow and lead by example on this by making sure that they're wearing their masks in public places, that they're encouraging others to do that, that they're discouraging the politics around that. And that goes a long way in providing the leadership that everyone else can step up to. And it comes down to, you know, everybody doing their part to keep themselves, their families, other strangers safe from spreading this disease so that we can get our economy going again, so that we can get our children successfully back in the classroom, so that we can start to make sure that we're in a better place as we face this winter, which we know is going to drive us indoors and is going to make that infection rate go even higher. So it's very disappointing. We're all frustrated. We're really struggling to get through this, and we've got to pull together, especially considering we've got a tough winter that's coming ahead.
There's pretty solid evidence, and I was just reading this morning about it, that some of the recovery packages, emergency assistance that's been passed by Congress and signed by the president, have really helped stave off even a worse economic disaster from happening. There's concern right now that the failure to pass another package could hurt the economy coming up in the weeks and months ahead. Do you support another round of recovery assistance? The Democratic House passed a measure, I think, $3 or $3.5 trillion. The president's talked about one or whatever. The numbers are mind-boggling, but still, the previous packages seem to have helped. Definitely. Do you support more assistance, and what should the elements of that be, and are you looking at a specific amount?
Obviously, we need another relief package. People are hurting. They still need the relief. And again, until we get this infection rate down, we know that our economy is still going to be struggling. And so we've got to get relief to the people who need it so that the damage isn't greater than we already know it's going to be. So we know that people have lost their jobs through no fault of their own, and those jobs are not back yet. And so we have to make sure that we're providing that unemployment relief. We don't want people to not be able to pay their rent, and we know that landlords can only go so long. So we cannot have people getting evicted and being added to our homelessness ranks, which are already too high. We have to recognize that some aspects of the economy have been hurt much more than others. And so it's clear that the hospitality industry, the retail industry, those folks need some assistance. And we have to make sure that we're keeping our cities and our counties able to continue to provide services. And we certainly don't want them having to lay off police officers and firefighters because of this. And so, yeah, we need to get this relief passed again. And, you know, I think it's interesting that the first relief package proved that Washington can work well when they put their minds to it, right? It was passed in a pretty timely fashion. And I would think it should be, a good model for them to get the second one passed. We need to learn from that first one. It wasn't perfect, and there needs to be a lot of transparency and a lot of accountability to make sure that the money is going to the places that it needs to go to, and that certain special interests are not taking advantage of this crisis in our country. And so I think we should be able to learn from that package and make the second package that much better. So again, it just takes people who are willing to figure that out. And yeah, they're far apart, but that's what negotiation is all about. That's what those conversations need to be like. And if they keep front and center why they're doing this, you know, that it's not about the politics, it's about getting the relief to the folks that need it the most. And as long as they have that priority in mind, they can get this done. And I hope they get it done and get it out there as fast as possible.
Do you think, on a couple specific elements, keeping the unemployment, the supplemental unemployment higher number, some folks felt like that was a disincentive to work. That's one, and then the other is assistance to state and local governments. Are those two things you should be a part of this package?
Sure, and it is a negotiation, right? I've never read anywhere where that $600 is a magic number. And so I think we should be listening to the employers and the unemployment folks and see what makes sense and land on a figure that is beneficial to us rather than a detriment. And same thing with the cities and the counties. Let's make sure they're part of that conversation But in the end, we know that their bottom line has been hurt by this, and we have to get them the relief that they need so that they're not having to lay people off or to cut services. That's their only recourse.
It seems critical because, to me anyway, our economy as everybody knows, just tanked last spring. Unemployment shot up to, really high levels. And while it's dropped back down, we're still way higher than we were back last winter. And it just seems like this economy is not going to get back to its former self until this virus is brought under control.
That's obvious. That's so obvious, Robin. And the other thing is that, we talked about before the pandemic what a strong economy we have, but the reality there is it was really strong for some people, for some folks, for some entities, but pretty darn soft for a huge chunk of the economy. The fact that people were in a situation where they did not have the ability to go without one paycheck or two tells us how soft that economy was for the people who are at the bottom end of the rung.
One of the key elements of getting this economy going is obviously our relations with the global trade, globalization, and specifically China. As I mentioned in the introduction, you and your husband farm, and farming is obviously a huge part of the global economy and the prosperity of the Iowa economy in the Midwest, and the nation as a whole. On the other hand, with China, we've ever since the WTO and China's entry into the global trading system, no question that our manufacturing base in eastern Iowa especially has just been decimated due to global trade. Agriculture's benefited for the most part, but manufacturing's really been hit hard. How do we balance that, especially now with China becoming almost an adversary in our global relations? How do we balance the positive possibilities, say, of agriculture with the continuing competition, it's sometimes unfair competition, that China and other countries bring?
That's something that farmers are very upset about, actually, is that we are not, in the eyes of many of farmers, that China is not being held accountable. That's one thing that this administration decided to get into this trade war. And when I was in the Senate, and I made that point on the Senate floor that this is very dangerous and risky for farmers, because when you enter into a trade war, it usually ends up poorly for farmers. And so that's what we've seen as a result, that our markets have gone way down. We have had this problem coming up with a trade agreement with China, and so we waited for that trade agreement forever, and now we've got a trade agreement of phase one, but it doesn't have teeth in it. We're not sure if China's going to fulfill their obligation there, and while we championed, the idea of holding China accountable. One of the things that we really are upset about is their intellectual property theft, and that's not even in this agreement. It's a promise in the second phase, but we've given this administration 3.5 years, and as a result, we are no better off, and we continue to have the taxpayers pay us with relief packages. So that doesn't sit well with any of us. Farmers want to be able to produce a product, and we do a great job of it. We're extremely efficient with it, and we know how to feed the world. We want to be paid for that product in a way that we can be financially solvent and not have to be subsidized accordingly. So I think that where we went wrong here was to not band with our allies in our efforts to hold China accountable. And again, it's not been working out well for us in our decision making here to go alone.
one of the casualties of this whole process and changed outlook of the Trump administration on global trade was the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Its backers said that this was going to open markets for us and, more importantly, provide some allies in Asia as kind of a counterbalance to China, growing China influence. Folks that were skeptical about it felt, again, that the common complaints about trade agreements is it didn't do enough to protect against unfair competition here and also some environmental concerns. If you're elected, is that something you'd be interested in bringing back and would be interested in supporting?
Well, I absolutely think that is crucial to us, that we lead the world in creating that kind of diplomacy and willingness to forge good alliances with our allies and be smart about how we take on entities like China who had not been, reliable in their dealings with us. And so it's tricky. It's not easy. I think that it's something that we've got to have the right people at the table to do. But I think that's exactly where it's at. I think that farmers should be at front and center. You know, we always have farm groups that are going across to many different countries to forge trade alliances. They're good at it. They know what they want. They know what it's going to take. We've got to work together in a diplomatic way, but in a tough way to get the kinds of deals that are going to be good for all of us.
We've talked here about the agriculture economy and the obvious slump that it's in because of the trade wars we're in. But you know, as you know, being from a rural area, you know, the rural economy is more than just agriculture. It's an important part, but there's other elements to it. What else do you think we need to do as somebody who lives in a rural area to help lift the rural economy? Most of these counties were performing better economically, but still incomes weren't as high as more urban areas. College degree levels weren't as high as well. I mean, what else can we do other than get the farm economy going to help these rural areas?
Well, there's several things we can do with the farm economy first, and that does have a ripple effect on many other businesses and on school districts and everything else. But in general, rural economic development is something that I really have enjoyed working with the people in my Senate district. I do think that economic development is local. You have to listen to the local people who understand what their strengths are and what they'd like to see happen in their local districts. There's some things that are necessary for rural economic development to occur, though, and those I think are pretty clear to me. We have to have high speed internet everywhere if we're going to help rural Iowa succeed. Especially today in this post-pandemic world, we've seen where it's crucial for our educational purposes that everybody needs to be able to study from home, and that means you have to have high-speed internet. It also is clear in our job lives that people who can work from home are at an advantage here, and as we see the ripple effect of people who are living in large cities who are saying, I'd like to get away from this congestion and I'd like to live somewhere else. They will not choose to live. I mean, rural Iowa is a great place to come and live. I'm a big fan and I think it's an awesome place to live. But people aren't going to choose to live here unless they can work here as well. And that means they have to have high-speed internet. And it has to be affordable. The other thing I think is crucial is rural Iowa has got to have access to good health care. Our rural hospitals were suffering before the pandemic. It's unclear where they're at right now, but we have to make sure that you can live in rural Iowa and be close to the health care that you need. And there's also quality of life issues. I think that it comes down to local choices. People in the local areas need to be listened to so that we can provide them with the resources so that they can take off and do the things that are really going to make a difference. And that is part of where small businesses come in, because small businesses are the bedrock of rural Iowa, and they have got to succeed here too, but because they have access to high-speed internet, because their employees can have the health care that they need close by. Those are all such important things. And I think that there's a great opportunity here for us if we can just provide the resources that allow good decisions to be made. That's one thing that I hope, if I'm elected as a representative to Congress, that I would dedicate one staffer totally to economic development across this district. You know, we have 22 counties of pretty rural Iowa here, and they need a little attention, so we have one staffer who works with each town, each county, to accomplish the goals that could really make a difference for them.
You mentioned healthcare, which I agree is critical for rural areas. The hospitals are more often than not the biggest employers. But my question is this: with the likely change of the makeup of the Supreme Court coming up and a major case working its way through the courts, that would, in all probability, if things go the way a lot of experts say, declare the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. What elements of that act and about health care reform generally do you think are most important? If that happens and you're elected, what are some of the key elements of the Affordable Care Act that if it is overturned, that you're going to want to get put back into place as soon as possible if you're elected to Congress?
I think that's pretty obvious. I think people have made that very clear, that the things that they like the most about the health care that they have right now is that insurance companies are held accountable for pre-existing conditions, and that their children can be left on their plan until they're 26. I think it's really unconscionable, really, that the Republicans are looking to repeal this act when they don't have, there is not a bill in place to replace it. They talk about repeal and replace, but there's no replacement. And this lawsuit is on the docket in November. People need their health care, and this repealing this legislation would throw millions of Americans off their insurance, and that's just so unnecessary. It just doesn't make sense for us to do anything but to improve what we have rather than to go backwards. We can fix what's broken, but you can't leave people in the lurch with a repeal program that does not have a replacement.
I got a final question for you here. We got about a minute left, but you can feel free to take a little more than that if you'd like. But I'm curious, if you're successful, what two or three committees would you ask to be on? And then if there's a first piece of legislation, the first one, what would it be? What would it reflect your top priority for trying to do as a newly elected representative from this district?
So I'm ready to serve in any capacity, but I think my passions lead me to, obviously, to have an interest in serving on labor and education, and also on the ag committees. I would just add to that one of the things that I did not talk about that is crucial for economic development and part of our infrastructure is child care. And so that ties in with education and with the efforts that we need to do to improve the economy by doing a better job of our child care industry. And then as far as the first bill that I would like to be able to vote on, you can actually look at readahart.com, and I talk about this pretty in-depth, is that we have got to fix the corruption in the system so that people have more faith in it and that it works better for all of us. And so I'd like to see us vote. I'd like my first vote to be on a bill that bans Congress people from ever serving as lobbyists. I'd like to see us tackle campaign finance reform. My goodness, we definitely need that. We need to make sure that special interests are not driving the campaign process, and we've got to get rid of gerrymandering. You know, Iowa has a good model here, and we see what happens across the country and how it's affecting all of us, that these districts are able to gerrymander and have these spider web kinds of situations where, therefore, people become cynical about their ability to make change and to hold their congressperson responsible and accountable. We've got to make some of those fixes, and if we can do that, then we can make some headway on a lot of other issues.
All right. Former State Senator Rita Hart from nearby Wheatland. She's a family farmer, her and her husband. She's been our guest today. She's the Democratic candidate for the 2nd Iowa Congressional District, the seat currently held by Dave Loebsack, who's retiring. It's one of the most closely watched races in the country, and we've had both candidates on now, so folks that are still looking at this race can have a chance to compare the views and make a good choice. Senator, thank you so much for taking the time out of what I'm sure is a crazy busy schedule to be our guest today.
Well, it's all my pleasure, Robin, and thank you for doing what you're doing here and helping people to understand the issues better and make good decisions when it comes to the voting booth. Thanks so much.
Thank you.